ingredients, then the game changes in regards to toxicity for the bee. And then Johnson and Berenbaum and et al. Have shown that you can even take this compound and add to it piperonyl butoxide as a synergist and make it extremely toxic. I mean, this is a 9 nanograms per bee LD50, so that's acute toxicity, not looking at even sublethal effects. So there's a lot of issues in regards to just what is happening relative to all the different interactions that are possible with just this one product and this one detection alone. So our future goals are to address some of these main players relative to looking at the pesticides that we have found, whether they're hazardous to bees, particularly looking at the chlorpyrifos and cumaphosphovalinate and other pyrethroids. We've seen 5 different pyrethroids in some samples. So just that alone and the impact pyrethroids are known to have on foraging behavior, just what might be in regards to the behavior, sublethal effects of these chemical residues on the what is used to identify colony collapse. So there's systemic fungicides. I mentioned mycobutanil and cyclodinil are found at high levels, enough of a level that they could synergize the co-occurring neonicotinoids, organophosphates for pyrethroids. The autocarb detections were noted mostly from Florida, well, they were noted relative to citrus screening applications. And the other factor is that what we have done so far is mostly a monofactorial approach, and we need to, as Dennis and others have mentioned already, to go to looking at what is the interacting players and a multifactorial approach to analysis, particularly whether or not pesticides are stress factor or trigger for what is a virus that's going to be mentioned in just a few moments, and other viruses that have been detected relative to CCD. So the other thing is inerts are not inert. And when you throw adjuvants into the system, you're changing the toxicology dramatically. So we want to reconstitute all this into laboratory situations where we can know what the bees are exposed to, what they ingest, and what the impact is on the pesticide or the honeybee health. To do this, we're doing other, we're carrying on studies that are real-life situations of apples, both in conventional and reduced-risk blocks within Pennsylvania. We're looking at neonics and homeowner products in regards to consequences to nectar pollen, and as well as using solitary bees. With Dennis Van Engelsdorp, we're tracking free migratory operations relative to pesticide incidents in regards to the health of the colony. And we're trapping pollen from colonies in different cropping systems to get an idea of just the complexity. And at the same time, we're investigating possible interactions with viruses such as the Israeli acute paralytic virus with Diana Cox Foster as the major collaborator. So I'd like to thank just our particularly the funding sources, the National Honey Board, and the beekeepers associations that have helped to make this possible, and as well as the NC508 and the Hatch funds that have been used to fund this work, and as well as the collaborators in the Colony Collapse Disorder Working Group, and others that are associated with Penn State that have again provided resources in order to accomplish what we're doing. And with that, I'll entertain. I won't entertain the question. Thank you.
Insects, and also cooperative breeding and hunting vertebrates. And these groups, these form the vast majority of social groups across taxa and typically consist of unrelated individuals, each of which is at least capable of reproducing. But there's little known about the causes or consequences of division of labor in these non-eusocial groups. So we ask, what are the origins of division of labor? When, during social evolution, does it arise, and how does it form? And the classical view, partly driven by studies of eusocial insects, is that division of labor is a product of mutation and selection in derived or advanced societies. It's thought to be this key adaptation of sociality, and this is partly true, but there's an alternate, although not mutually exclusive, hypothesis that division of labor can self-organize from interactions among individuals and between individuals in their environment, and that these interactions can generate behavioral differentiation. And therefore, division labor may even emerge spontaneously in incipient groups with no history of social evolution. And this can be tested by forming artificial groups from normally solitary systems. And that's what we have done. This does not mean that division labor does not evolve or is not an adaptation, just that it can originally emerge as kind of an epiphenomenon of group living and then can subsequently be fine-tuned into the elaborate patterns we see in ants and honeybees. So there are numerous potential mechanisms that have been proposed to explain how division labor self-organizes. These include models based on response thresholds, reinforcement, and spatial separation, but I won't be addressing those directly in this study. So a really good model system for studying changes in division labor during social evolution is Lazioblossom. This is a cosmopolitan genus of ground-dwelling sweat bees, and it includes solitary, communal, and eusocial species. Some populations are even facultatively eusocial. However, we focus on the Australian Lazioblossom, which form a monophyletic clade of communal and solitary societies. But no eusocial Lazioblossom in Australia. And the communal ones seem not to be an intermediate state between solitary and eusocial. So again, we're interested in whether division labor can emerge in groups with no history of social evolution. So we chose a normally solitary species, Lazioblossom NDA1. And we forced associations, in this case pairs, of females, and observed them during the nest foundation stage and compared them to single females in the laboratory. And we asked three questions that I'll address for this talk. First, most generally, just how does being in a group affect the task performance of these normally solitary bees? Does division of labor appear, and if so, is it emergent? And finally, from our previous studies of ant founders associations, we found that individuals that specialize in excavation are more likely to die than non-specialists. So here we ask for this, if there's individuals that specialize in excavation, does it have a cost in terms of survival? And for communal or quasi-social groups where all individuals can potentially reproduce, then division labor could generate fitness disparities if some tasks are more costly than others, so it's important to track. Here's a brief overview of our methods. We introduce either single bees or pairs to these artificial observation nests, consisted of soil with a connecting tube to a vial that contained honey water up here. And we marked individuals and observed their behavior across 5 days and identified three major tasks that we focused on for our analyses. Excavation, which occurred at the bottom of the tunnel with a bee excavating soil with her mandibles. And typically they only dug one linear tunnel, so only one bee could excavate at a time. Pushing tamping, we pulled together because they generally co-occurred. Pushing was a bee pushing soil out towards the entrance with her legs, and they tamped or packed soil into the sidewalls of the tunnels with their abdomens. And then finally, gatekeeping. This we defined as a bee sitting at the upper extremity at the entrance or in the connecting tube facing up. And this behavior resembles what's been described as guarding in Halictine bees pretty widely. We didn't have any intruders in our experiment that they could react towards, but if one of us stuck a toothpick in the entrance, then they would assume an aggressive C posture, the gatekeeper would. And we also measured tunnel length and tracked survival over 16 days. So this first set of graphs shows per capita task performance expressed in terms of the mean proportion of observations. And don't pay attention so much to the changes over time as the comparison between the single bees in white and the paired individuals in green. So you can see there wasn't a significant difference in the frequency of excavation per capita between single versus paired bees. And likewise, pushing tamping did not differ between the two treatments. However, for gatekeeping, paired bees performed much more gatekeeping than single bees. And despite those differences, there were no differences in overall activity. It was pretty low across the board. So this is for per capita performance, but when you combine the behavior of paired bees, we have about twice the excavation, twice the pushing tamping, and they correspondingly dug about twice as far. And paired nests also performed four times the gatekeeping. So now looking at behavioral differences within the pairs and how those compare to what the solitary bees were doing. Here for this graph, we have the number of observations on the y-axis, and I'm going to reveal the multiple tasks along the x. And within each pair, we designated a high-frequency and a low-frequency excavator just based on the nestmate's relative frequency of excavation. And within most pairs, there was a significant asymmetry with a contingency test. And so it's not surprising that the mean for the high frequency is higher than the low frequency excavators here for this task, because that's how we define them. We did do a resampling analysis to show that the degree of differentiation between the high and low frequency excavators was greater than would be expected.